Well, thank you, Johannes. I'm going to have to read this, otherwise I'll never get it right. I should point out that Emma will be 100 on November the 6th, which is not all that far from today. And she exerted a great deal of influence on the early development of computational number theory. The organizers of this meeting thought it would be appropriate if this milestone were acknowledged here. I'm pleased to be able to tell you that Emma is in good health and spirits, although a little forgetful. She still loves to walk with friends in the Berkeley Hills, always did. Her daughter Laura says she also loves to receive cards with landscapes and flowers on them. I think you got the flowers, Renata. Furthermore, she suggests that it would be nice if friends who would like to celebrate her birthday would send cards at any time during November or perhaps later, so they would not all arrive at the same time. I should say something about these pictures that you see here. The top one was the picture that was taken on her wedding day when she was 22. The others were taken somewhat later, and let me see if I can... This one was taken by the late Paul Holmos. Paul Holmos may or may not know passed away on the 2nd of this month. And this last picture was taken at the 1969 Computers and Number Theory Conference that was held in Oxford. There aren't many pictures of Emma, and you'll understand why in a little while, but I do have one that I was able to acquire. With any luck, I'll be able to get it back on this machine. This is a very recent picture. It was sent to me by John Brillhart just a little while ago. She is playing there with something called polygonzo. I have no idea what polygonzo is, but that's what she's playing with. I first met Emma during the early 70s, and the last time I saw her was at a special meeting held in honor of the Lamer's contributions to Berkeley at the end of August in year 2000. During that span of almost 30 years, I got to know her very well, particularly during the year I spent visiting her and Dick at Berkeley in 83-84. Details of Emma's life and her work are fairly well documented, so I thought that I would confine most of my remarks to my personal remembrances of her. I must say that I have very much enjoyed this opportunity to travel down memory lane. As I hope you will see, my experiences with the Lamers were always pleasant, stimulating, and rewarding. Emma was born Emma Markovna Trotskaya in 1906 in the town of Samara in Russia, and from there moved about 4 years later to Harbin in Manchuria. She lived, as they say, in interesting times. She has documented her early remembrances as My Life and Times. It's a memoir written in 1992 and can be found in the Lamer Conference program of the very meeting that I talked about just earlier. As a result of the tumult caused by the Russian Revolution, she decided to apply to Berkeley for entry. Berkeley was a university which had already accepted several other students from Harbin. She was offered a place for entry in 1924, and she enrolled in an engineering degree, but after a couple of years, she dropped engineering and moved to mathematics as her main subject. Her favorite mathematics lecturer at Berkeley was Derek Norman Lamer, and as well as taking several of his courses, she did a research project with him in finding pseudo-squares, and that would be a subject that would occupy her for many years to come, and myself, for that matter. It was at this time that she met his son, Derek. I'm not entirely sure that this was an accident. She graduated with a BA degree with honors in mathematics in 1928. I might point out that Derek Norman, was working on a project that involved what are called factor stencils. This was a way of factoring numbers where you found some, you found some characteristics of a number, and you put the stencils that satisfied this you piled them up. And then you looked through, and you found if there was a hole that went all the way through. And that would indicate a number that would be a factor of the number you were trying to factor. It sounds very primitive today. But you have to understand, this is a long time ago, and factoring has, advanced considerably since that time. in any event, the work involved in this required a lot of very busy scut work of punching holes in these stencils. I mean, they had this little stencil hole puncher, and I guess the two of them put together doing all of this stuff, well, you know, nature took its course. So, in the same year that she got her degree, her BA degree with honors in 1928, she married Dick. And that began a matrimonial and mathematical partnership that would last 63 years until Dick's death in 1991. During this period, Emma wrote about 60 papers, of which 21 were co-authored with Dick. After Dick's death, she made sure that his as yet unpublished work was published, and then retired from any further mathematical work. Most of her published work was on cyclotomy and reciprocity rules. Today, this sort of research is no longer considered fashionable, but mathematical fashion was not something that bothered Emma very much. She did what she did because she enjoyed both the process of discovery and the beauty of the results. Well, what better reason? While Emma did not have a PhD, she did get a master's degree at Brown in 1930. In an article entitled On the Advantages of Not Having a PhD, she wrote the following. First of all, there are lower expectations. If one happens to discover something new, one's peers are pleasantly surprised and generous in their praise. This is good for the morale. At this point, I want to discuss an aspect of Emma's personality that is well known to those who know her, and that is that she is modest to a fault. Dick Lamer wrote over 200 research papers and is rightly credited with making computational number theory an academic subject worthy of pursuit by serious scholars. What is not well known is that Emma played a very important, indeed I would say essential, part in all of this work. Given her contribution, she should have been listed as a co-author on many more than 21 papers with Dick. But she would not permit her name to appear. This was, I must stress this, Emma's decision. I remember one particular instance of this when Dick and the other four authors, John Brillhart, John Selfridge, Bryant Tuckerman, and Sam Wagstaff, of the now well-known book on factorizations of b to the n minus 1 for values of b between 2 and 12, two high powers, often referred to informally as the Cunningham Project, tried to persuade her to allow her name to appear as an author. All the authors were aware that Emma had made a very significant contribution to this work, in fact, more than some of them had, but she would not hear of having her name included in the list of authors, saying that it already had five authors and that was enough. When Emma said no, she meant no. There was no further discussion. I remember another instance of this when Emma brought out some pictures of Dick in which she thought I might have some interest. These were photo proofs taken by and signed by Alfred Eisenstadt. Anybody here know Alfred Eisenstadt? No, he was a very famous photographer. Well, maybe you know something else. There is a very famous photograph that was taken on VJ Day in New York of a sailor kissing a nurse. You know this picture? It's quite famous. That was taken by Alfred Eisenstadt. He was one of the four original photographers for Life magazine. Very, very famous. I asked Emma why a photographer as famous as Eisenstadt was taking pictures of Dick. And she responded by saying that Life magazine had sent him to do a photo story on her and Dick. Apparently the editors of Life thought that the partnership of two mathematicians was worthy of report. This is a great honor because Life magazine at that time was one of the preeminent, if not the preeminent, mass market journals in the U.S. The other one was Time magazine. I think that the comment was that Time was for people who couldn't think and Life was for people who couldn't read. None of this made an impression on Emma. She hated to be photographed and thought the whole business would be patronizing and silly. She would not participate and therefore there could be no story. Did I mention that when Emma said no, she meant no? After relating this story to me, she did something quite extraordinary. She gave me these pictures. There was to be no discussion. They were mine. I wondered at the time whether she had any idea of their value, but now I'm convinced that she did. Given her enormous mathematical talent, it may seem peculiar that she would want to remain in the background. I once asked her about this, and while my memory concerning certain aspects of her response is vague, I do recall her mentioning an incident when her children were quite young. She had two children, Laura and Don, during which she became distracted by some mathematical discussion, and the children, as children will, got themselves into a situation that could have resulted in some trouble for them. They were never in any real danger, but this event caused Emma to decide to focus on her family. Thus, she never became a professional mathematician. This is to some degree forced upon her as well because of Berkeley's strict anti-nepotism policy, which forbade two married people from being members of the same department. This policy was suspended briefly during World War II, during which Emma was allowed to teach, but was reinstituted after the war. In all my discussions with her, she never expressed any regret about her decision. As John Brillhart, a former student of Dick's, has rightly pointed out, as a faculty wife, she was a member of the university community, had library privileges, and never felt excluded from the mathematics community. She was able to attend department seminars whenever she wanted, and she was able to travel with her husband to attend mathematics conferences around the world. So, all the bad, all the good things, and she didn't have to teach undergraduates. Contrary to opinions that I have heard from others, Emma also never indicated any resentment about how she was treated by Berkeley. In her view, she had been treated very well. Emma delighted in the company of most of the famous number theorists of the time and made her home a place for the discussion of mathematics and whatever else was of interest. I remember thinking when I was there that her home was like a latter-day French salon or an English drawing room where people would go for the stimulating discussions and the interesting company. She opened her doors to some of the most high-maintenance people I have ever met and rarely complained about their behavior. I have stories about that, but I won't say them here. She certainly made her home available to Dick's graduate students. I remember one instance when Peter Weinberger, a former student of Dick's, was visiting the house. And after dinner, without being asked, simply started washing all the dishes and putting them away. He knew where everything went. Whenever I visited Berkeley, it was simply assumed that I would be staying there. I always enjoyed my visits there because it's a home full of ideas and utterly devoid of tension. I also think that Emma might have had a hidden agenda. Dick was teetotal, but Emma liked a glass of wine from time to time. During my visit, she had an excuse to have one. Just one. After I would come back from the university, the evening routine would go as follows. There would be some discussion of the day's activities, and then Emma would make the evening meal. We would eat, and then Dick and I would clear the table and wash the dishes. After that, there would be time for conversation and perhaps some guests, often the Robinsons. The Robinsons, perhaps you're aware of Julia Robinson. They would just drop by. And about 10 p.m., people would go home, and Dick would retire for the night. Then Emma would turn on the TV, the only time during the day she ever turned on the TV. Attached by a wire to the TV was a rather cumbersome device that Emma could use to mute the commercials. And she did this with a zealous satisfaction. After the news, it was time for tea and cookies, and then she would go to bed. I should point out that I, personally, never drink tea or eat cookies. But I did at Emma's. I understand that recently her doctor has given her a new medicine that has significantly improved her energy, so she is able to serve tea and cookies again at her house, much to her pleasure. During my many stays, I was able to observe how the Lamers conducted their research activities. They would work on different problems or different aspects of the same problem in separate places in their home. At lunchtime and before supper, they would discuss the results of what they had been doing. Often Emma would have some idea what might be going on in her investigations, or as she would say, the numbers are beginning to speak to me. But needed some computations done. When this happened, Dick would program the computer to obtain the data that she needed. Thus, each was very much involved in the work of the other. That is why it's so difficult to separate the contributions. Emma did, but I'm afraid not to the best advantage of her mathematical posterity. Unlike Dick, Emma was a very faithful correspondent. I remember several instances of writing Dick about some technical point and receiving response from Emma. After this occurred sufficiently frequently, I just wrote Emma. This reminds me of many discussions I had with Dan Shanks. During the mid to late 60s, Dan was formulating what would turn out to be some very important contributions to computational number theory, particularly to the problem of computing the class group of a quadratic field. He initiated a lengthy correspondence with the Lamers, which he characterized as some of the most important work of his life. The Lamers, particularly Emma, kept encouraging him, and he kept producing. Dan kept all of this correspondence and instructed his son to give it to me after his death. It is a real delight to peruse this material. You can see how Dan was developing his ideas because he would write practically on a daily basis. The baby step, giant step method, which is now used so routinely, appears for the first time in a letter that he wrote to the Lamers. They had provided him with a certain discriminant and essentially challenged him to find the class number of the corresponding quadratic field, which he did. Almost all the letters sent back to Dan were from Emma, with occasionally a hastily written note from Dick attached. By now it should be clear that Emma loves to chat. I recall one time when I brought one of my graduate students to the Lamers, the address 1180 Miller Ave. Anyone who knows the Lamers still knows that address. I can remember that without having to look it up. I wanted him to talk to Dick and Emma about their number sieves because he was thinking of building one himself. Emma very skillfully steered him and Dick away to another room so that the two of us could drink lemonade and have a lengthy conversation. At that time, Emma had met my children and wanted to be brought up to date on all of their activities. After Dick's death, I continued to visit 1180 Miller Ave. I was doing some research for what would ultimately be my book, and I needed some data that was in Emma's possession. The routine stayed the same, but I remember her telling me about Dick's last day. Dick had suffered a stroke and as a result was not able to walk, something that he greatly missed because he loved walking. I can remember many lovely days in California walking around Marin County with Dick and Emma. Their house is not exactly wheelchair friendly, so it was decided to install an exterior elevator that could be used to move Dick in his wheelchair from the house to the outside and back. Dick spent the entire day watching the workman install this device with a greater and greater expression of glumness. The very next day he was gone. Shortly thereafter, Emma lost her short-term memory and has not recovered it. Both Dick and Emma were very active politically. They were lifelong Democrats and considered Republicans to be either some sort of antediluvian throwbacks or at best simply misguided. I'm not exactly certain of the origin of their politics, but I can easily imagine that the loyalty oath must have had something to do with it. Now, you wouldn't remember any of this, but... As a result of the workings of the House Un-American Activities Committee and other concerns about communist infiltration of various American institutions, in 1950, the Board of Regents of the state of California decided to implement a policy that all employees sign a loyalty oath. And the University of California at Berkeley was chosen as one of the first test cases for it. 19 faculty members of the University of California refused. In fact, Dick, with Emma's full support, just stalked off the Berkeley campus to take a non-California job at UCLA under the National Bureau of Standards as director of the Institute for Numerical Analysis. This act made the university angry since he just left, and as a result he lost his position. After the courts proclaimed the oath to be unconstitutional, Lamer was reinstated at Berkeley. However, during his tenure at Standards, he ran up against Richard Milhouse Nixon. At the time, Nixon was vice president of the U.S. He had some corporate buddy who claimed to have manufactured a new kind of automobile battery, which is much better than those currently on the market, purportedly. In order to get some kind of official imprimatur concerning the efficacy of this product, he submitted it to Standards for evaluation. Unfortunately for him, Standards was unable to find this product at any advantage over any other products currently on the market. Corporate buddy appealed to Nixon, who tried to bring pressure upon bear on Standards to change their finding. He was unsuccessful, so he influenced Congress not to give the Bureau its budgeted money, and they dropped running the operation at UCLA. Well, at that point, the Navy took it over, which fortunately did not affect Dick's status at all. Nevertheless, Dick and Emma were disgusted by Nixon's clumsy and improper attempt to pressure a government agency and never forgave him. It must have been very difficult for them not to gloat during the Watergate scandal. The laymen were given to understand that the FBI had actually compiled a file on their activities. I guess it would be hard for the FBI to resist keeping tabs on a couple of left-leaning academics that did a lot of traveling, especially considering that Emma was born in what was then the USSR. After the American Freedom of Information Act became law, the Lamers petitioned to see this file. They were astonished and appalled that any agency of the federal government would go so much trouble to record such a collection of banal and innocuous activities. Well, I could go on at much further length, but I think I should close, according to the clock, with another observation made by John Brillhart. In the 60 years during which they collaborated, the Lamers were a research team who personally influenced a large number of people with their knowledge, their courtesy, and sociability, and the fine mathematical work. There is little doubt that one of the most enduring contributions to the world of mathematics is their founding of the West Coast Number Theory meeting in 1969. This meeting, which has been held in the western United States in December of every year since that time, has provided an informal and often merry, I think perhaps other words could be used for merry, but we'll use that, environment in which old friends can meet and younger mathematicians can present their work. This meeting will remain a lasting tribute to the Lamers. And this year, I have to point out that for the first time, the meeting will not be held in the U.S. It will be held in Mexico. Okay, I think that that's enough for me. Thank you very much for your attention.
What happens with the material you receive? Are you going to make it public?
Which, oh, you know, I have been thinking, oh, you mean the, oh yes, I have that full collection. I have been thinking actually of doing that, but it's going to take an awful lot of work. I was thinking of just editing all of Dan's collected works. I have an awful lot of his unpublished material. After he died, I cleared out his office, and I took, and his house. Well, that was an interesting experience. I won't go there. It was an interesting, as I say, experience. And I have a lot of this stuff. Some of it, sometimes people ask me for copies, and I send it to them. But if you want to know anything about Dan or his work, I probably have it somewhere in my file. Someday, as I say, I may have the time to publish his works. I'd like.